listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO. I'm your host, Andy Waite. It is time for Creation Club. Good morning, Pastor Wirth.
Good morning, Andy.
Well, what do you have for us today? It's time for a lot of people to go back to school. Are all the big yellow limousines roaming around your neighborhood?
They are. School started here in the Fox School District on the 14th. How about where you live?
Oh, yes. I usually make it out on the road before all the big yellow limousines make it out. But some mornings, if I'm running late, then I get to share the road with them and see all the kids out waiting for school, getting ready to go back. And some of them happy about it, some of them not so happy about it. More parents that are happy about it, it seems like, this time of year.
So it seems.
Well, what do you have for us in Creation Club this morning?
Well, you know, as people go back to school and they get back into the swing of things, you know, our many children in many schools, public schools and private schools and even some religious schools, will hear in their science classes about evolution. And sometimes one of the arguments that gets made is that the majority of scientists believe this story, that life came from non-living matter, and gradually over millions and billions of years, you know, it became more and more complex, and that's how we got here. So why wouldn't you believe it if the majority of scientists believe it? So what should we make of that kind of an argument? If the majority of scientists believe it, can they be wrong? Well, let's look at some scientific history. You know, all the way back to the days of Aristotle, who lived in the 4th century B.C., so some 300 years at least, you know, before the birth of Jesus Christ, people had this idea of spontaneous generation. What is spontaneous generation? They believed that living organisms could come into being rapidly and spontaneously over a period of just days or weeks, just, you know, not out of non-living stuff, life would arise. And they had proof for it, you know, for a couple thousand years, people believed that this was the way things would happen. So one man by the name of Dr. von Helmont believed that mice would come from wheat and dirty underwear. And there was actually an experiment. You got a jar, and you put wheat in the jar, and then you put sweaty, dirty underwear in the jar with the wheat. And after 3 weeks, voila, what did you have? You had mice in the jar. And guess what? That was considered by scientists to be proof of spontaneous generation, that wheat and dirty underwear gives rise to mice spontaneously. Not exactly very good science. I mean, even an elementary school student today, I think, would figure that's not so smart. Well, there were other experiments that people thought proved spontaneous generation. After all, they could put raw meat in a dish. If they just wait a couple of weeks, what would appear? Maggots. Ugh. Rotting meat with maggots, and that was thought to, you know, that out of this meat spontaneously were generated maggots. But then somebody thought, you know, there's a way to test whether this is true or not. So they put cheesecloth, a piece of cheesecloth, over the meat to keep the flies off. And guess what? You know, even after the period of time when you would expect the maggots to appear, they didn't. The meat rotted, okay, but there were not maggots when the cheesecloth prevented the flies from laying their eggs on there. So, okay, so this took till 1668, you know, for somebody to prove this, you know. And, well, but people still believed in spontaneous generation even after that. And so they said, well, look at pond scum. You know, you can have clear water and it'll get pond scum on it. And so this is proof. In fact, some have even took the pond water, boiled it, poured it in a jar, and waited for spontaneous generation. Of course, they left the jar open, okay, after a few weeks. Sure enough, the water got cloudy, and they said, see, that proves spontaneous generation. We boiled the water, but it got cloudy anyway, and there's organisms in it, so see, that proves spontaneous generation. Well, finally then, in 1859, a French chemist by the name of Louis Pasteur thought he was going to check this out more fully. So what he did is he made a glass flask and put an S-shaped neck on it. So there was an S-shaped curve in it. And so they put the water in there. In fact, let's see, read. Pasteur started out with a flask filled with boiled meat broth. Then he heated the neck of the flask and stretched it. After heating the neck of the flask again, Pasteur made it in an S shape. The open end of the S shaped neck pointed upward. Due to gravity, bacteria from the air could only settle in the lowest part of the neck and were prevented from reaching the broth. Even after months of waiting, the liquid in the flask never became cloudy. Then, after being satisfied that that showed that spontaneous generation isn't true, he tilted the neck of the flask, allowing the liquid that had gathered in the bottom of that S-shaped entrance into the neck to flow into the body where the rest of the clear liquid was, and sure enough, in a short period of time, that became cloudy. The microorganisms that had settled in the neck contaminated the broth, and this proved that bacteria, in this case scum, did not form spontaneously from clear water. And so since Louis Pasteur and his work in 1859, people have realized, oh, spontaneous generation isn't true. But guess what? The theory of evolution depends on it, doesn't it? It has to have happened at least once, according to them, that out of non-living matter, life would somehow occur. Now think about it. Real observational science, since the days of Louis Pasteur, have shown again and again, life always comes from life. Life never comes from non-living matter. But the theory of evolution depends upon it. So the majority of scientists in the past were wrong by believing in spontaneous generation, and observational science has shown that that was a wrong idea, and yet they still cling to the idea in the form of belief in molecules to man evolution, that non-living matter can give rise to life somehow spontaneously if you have the right circumstances. But nobody has ever been able to show that in the laboratory by producing the right circumstances for life to arise. So again, the majority of scientists today who believe in molecules to man evolution are just as wrong as were those foolish people who thought that wheat and dirty underwear spontaneously generate mice. So that's kind of an interesting thing to contemplate. And you might want to call that to the attention of your students if they come home from school and say, Mom, why do we believe in the Bible when the majority of scientists believe in evolution? Okay, can we move on to another topic?
Sure.
Or do you have more to comment on that one?
Well, I was just thinking that would be an interesting experiment in the dorm with the first experiment that you mentioned. Never mind, let's go on to the next topic.
Pizza crust. Pizza crusts, beer cans, and dirty underwear. Yes, yes.
Speaking of experiments, a long-term evolution experiment.
Right. Actually, there's someone who believes in evolution, a leading evolutionary biologist by the name of Dr. Richard E. Lenski, has been widely recognized for his long-term evolution experiments, where several populations of E. coli bacteria have been adapting to laboratory media over 60,000 generations. So it's been going on for 20 years, and he had over 20 years, and they have over 60,000 generations of these E. coli, which they've observed, and they've noticed that there have been various changes in the E. coli. It says, though fitness gains decelerated after rapid increases within the first few thousand generations, an especially large fitness increase was observed when some E. coli populations evolved a, quote, key innovation. It is this moment in particular that captures the attention of many molecules to man evolution proponents, so it is important for creationists to have a good understanding of the experiment in order that we may defend and demonstrate the truth of God's word through its findings. And the author of the article here that is examining this is a man by the name of Scott Wynot, and he's a MD candidate to receive his MD this August. And the article is a little bit technical. You can find it at the Answers in Genesis website. The title of the article is Hijacking Good Science, Lenski's Bacteria Support Creation. And let me just summarize the main points, because the technical things would probably be hard for us to discuss in a short time on the radio here. But if people are interested, they can read the article for themselves at the Answers in Genesis website. But the gist of it is this, that at the end of all these generations, more than 60,000 generations of E. coli, have there been changes? Yes, but the E. coli are still E. coli. And what we actually see, his experiments actually demonstrate that the vast majority of the changes, particularly if they were beneficial changes, are actually due to the disruption, degradation, or loss of genetic information. And some examples of that, they talked about a particular piece of information, genetic information that was lost, and then allowed the expression of a gene that this particular part of the genetic code had suppressed. And in the particular environment that they were subjecting the E. coli to, that turned out to be beneficial, whereas the ones that didn't have that change were killed off. The ones that did have that change, you know, survived. But they survived not with more genetic information, but with less. They didn't have an improvement in the genetic code, but rather a degradation of the genetic code. But it turned out to be beneficial under certain circumstances, which the experimenters were in control of, to see what kind of changes they could observe if they would introduce certain changes in the environment of the organisms. So at the end of the day, when you get to the end of the article, after he's explained about a dozen reasons why this does not prove evolution but proves creation, he summarizes his points. And so he reminds us that there were no gains of novel information. That's a technical term in this field, I guess. The gain of novel information means that it must involve a mutational event or series of events that enable the production of a novel protein or proteins that can perform a specific and previously unknown activity. This type of mutation has not been observed, and yet that would be essential if evolution were true. And the fact that you, for over 20 years, have been manipulating these bacteria, hoping to induce genetic changes that you could observe and document, and it turns out that after more than 20 years and more than 60,000 generations, the E. coli remain E. coli, and whatever changes you induce in them are not by adding genetic information and by improving its genetic code, but by degradation of that when you introduce situations in the environment of the organisms that, to survive, you know, the ones that have a change that doesn't have this particular feature that they ordinarily would have, they survive, but they don't get new information. They've lost information. So that is not, in any correct understanding, proof of evolution. And yet that's going to be trotted out and is trotted out again and again by scientists who want to believe the fairy tale of molecules to man evolution, that, see, by these little bitty changes over millions and billions of years, you would be able to come up with people from scum to people, from goo to you. And so, again, we would say this is observational science, but it does not support evolution, even though it gets an evolutionary spin by those who want to believe in evolution, including this lead researcher, Dr. Richard Lenski, who does believe in evolution.
So, mainly the difference in a long-term experiment like this is that when something changes over time, is that the blueprint for it, if you will, is already there, is what I understand you to be saying. The blueprint's
correct.
Already there. So even when something changes, it's not changing from, as you said, from one species to another, but within that species, there are changes that are already coded or blueprinted in it for it to change over time.
There's already the ability to do various kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And in this kind of environment, it will do this. And if it's in a different environment where it can't do that, then it can do something else. Think about dogs, for example. You know, dogs already, the dog kind, you already have long-haired dogs, short-haired dogs, and all the other characteristics. Well, let's just deal with long-haired versus short-hair. You know, if you have dogs that are living in the equatorial regions of Earth, guess which kind of genetic information is going to be expressed and favored when it is expressed, namely short hair. You know, long-haired dogs are not going to do well in a hot equatorial environment. And so the expression of the long-haired genetic code is not going to come out in dogs there. You're going to be favored by having in nature by having short-haired dogs, as opposed to in polar regions, dogs that have thick fur coats are going to do better in that environment. And guess what? That, you know, dogs and wolves and, you know, dog kind critters that live in polar regions, you know, have thick coats of fur. Why? Because all dogs have in the genetic in dog kind, the genetic pool of dogs has both long-haired and short-haired varieties, thick coats and not-so-thick coats of fur. But depending upon the environment, what actually plays out in the kind that would survive would be how it would be expressed. And they're the ones that are going to successfully survive and mate and have young. So the dogs in equatorial regions are going to often have less heavy coats mm-hmm. of fur and not such long fur, as opposed to being in polar regions where, you know, that they can have that. And then, of course, we can play around with that ourselves. Human beings manipulate to get what we want by controlling breeding. So that in America, for example, where people have dogs as pets, if I want a long-haired dog, then I breed for long hair. And if I want a short-haired dog, I breed for short hair by controlling which dogs mate with which dogs and controlling the outcome that way. But see, that doesn't prove evolution at all. Instead, that goes back to pointing out that in each kind that God created, there's already a lot of genetic variation there, which can be expressed in different ways depending upon the environment and depending upon what's going on to control survival and reproduction. And so you know, you get to the whole matter of natural selection. What all natural selection means, it's differential reproduction rates. And nobody, you know, creationists don't disagree with that. In nature, you will have differential reproduction rates. If the conditions are hostile to one kind of this organism, they will die out, and ones that are not affected by the adverse conditions will survive. That fits right in with what God says in Genesis.
Amen. And there is Creation Club. That's it for today. Thank you so much.